we know around the world, actually, about the possibilities of reconstructing an economy, a society that has been basically wiped out by internal conflict for a substantial period of time. There was the obvious cases that everyone refers to of the Marshall Plan in Europe, of Germany, Japan, of reconstructing after World War II. Sort of a first explicit case of having international transfers of resources to rebuild war-damaged societies. And the rebuilding was relatively successful. In hindsight looking, there were a lot of skills. There were institutions in place. And so an inflow of resources were able to be used relatively effectively, and these societies reconstructed. Important parts of changes in governance, et cetera, were part of that story, but it was a relatively easy story. That began the whole notion of the international institutions that we know, the World Bank, the IMF, a number of UN agencies were in part played a role in this, but also was a sense that a way to help reconstruct countries from such things. Remember, the World Bank is the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, that model would work relatively easily, transfer some resources, a bit of technical assistance, and societies would be able to reemerge from the ashes. The experience has been mixed. International assistance has been helpful in some cases. It's been harmful in some cases. It has had minimal effects. In some, it has been helpful. And a more recent example that was very interesting was the whole matter of the Soviet bloc. After 88. In 89, as you had then major changes of government, so it was certainly a large amount of turmoil, and the sense that there's some transfer of resources and technical assistance would make for an easy transition. What we all know is that it was not an easy transition. Russia alone, that lost about 40% of GDP during World War II, lost about 50% between 88 and 98, and now there's recovery. But the key lesson there was just to transfer resources or to get government off the back of some processes and let markets start working again. There's a serious problem if you don't have the institutions that are necessary. Rule of law, ability to contract, ability of a government to be able to mobilize resources, to provide social services, the whole issue of a social safety net. All those issues rose again and again where these were very difficult transitions. And so the moral that we've drawn is it's not just resources, it's also institutions. Now, looking at a few developing countries, which is more important here, we have a few examples. Indonesia after 1968, Vietnam after 86, both have been relatively successful cases of countries coming back from disorganization, from conflict, et cetera. And there were, again, crucial issues was a reconstitution of some domestic political and civil society institutions with the primary initiative coming from the citizens, and particularly of rural reconstruction. What was happening at the villages had been a crucial part of the reconstruction of those cases. Let's look again at some more recent African cases. The one I know best that I've had the privilege of working on, off and on, has been Uganda, which by 86 had been through 20 years of disaster and decay and violence. And Uganda is a case that has successfully recovered, and I want to draw specifically on some of those lessons as I go on. Another interesting case was Eritrea, again involved for many, many years in civil war for independence, area heavily destroyed, and then the construction rather than reconstruction of a fairly effective state. The Eritrean message is particularly important, and that says diasporas can be very useful and very helpful. And I'll come back to it, but obviously, as I see it, this Liberian diaspora, I see here, their skills, There's know-how, there's resources. If it can be tapped in a constructive way, that actually is the most important resource that I think Liberia has to draw on. Mozambique is another case that, again, had devastating civil war for an extended period of time and has managed to reconstruct itself and is one of the relative success stories. I'd say in Uganda and Mozambique, what's very clear is that levels of absolute poverty have been reduced substantially. Benefits have gotten down, so there's more food, there's higher life expectancies, better health, restoration of education services that has been reaching down to the very poorest in important ways. And again, that's an issue I want to come back to. Another example nearby is Rwanda, that had obviously was split by fratricide for a period of time. It's a bit early to really assess the case, but there are some relatively encouraging pieces of news coming back from Rwanda. Other African examples, not as much straight conflict, but of reconstructing economies that had fallen on very hard days. Ghana and Tanzania are another couple of cases that are particularly interesting. If you look across these countries, and I'm thinking particularly the African cases, there are some lessons. The first is without security, you can do nothing. Security is the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth priorities. If people are killing each other, if you don't know what's happening from one day to the other, if you're subject to predation, that anything you have may be taken randomly, there are no incentives to draw. To sow crops, certainly to adopt new technologies, to do any of the kinds of things that people have to do for themselves to increase their real standards of living. So security is the first story. And I think you've discussed this also in the previous issues and how you restore security to a country that's been as torn apart as Liberia is obviously difficult issues, but that's the first thing that has to be addressed. A second case is to realize that government is going to be able to play a very limited role. The institutions of government have basically been destroyed. You don't have in place a functioning civil service. You don't have the basic institutions of law and order. The courts, again, have been undermined in important ways. All of those crucial institutions have been undercut. The ability to mobilize resources through some kind of a reasonable, fair tax system in order to provide basic social services and to direct resources to reconstruction, to investment, the ability is very limited. If you think you're going to write a constitution, have a government, and have government then take on these roles to rebuild the society, you're going to be disappointed. So the best thing is say, what capacity do you have? As I said, security is crucial. These basic institutions of law and order are absolutely crucial to begin to get some kind of a fiscal system working again. These are crucial requirements. But the point is, when you see what the capacity is at this point, given the experience of the last 20 years, you want to make sure that the assignments that you try to give to government are ones that can be carried out, that you have a chance of being successful. Aim a little bit low, obviously push expectations, but there's no surer way to absolutely destroy a government is by asking it to do more than it has the capacity to do. And then you're going to be back into various responses. Look, we've tried it. It hasn't worked. So how do you start reconstructing in this case, if you have security? There are sort of two. One is look at the rural economy. The vast majority of Liberians have lived in rural areas, have been displaced, various areas. But that's the basic basic economy, the village economies, is a place to start. To rebuild parts of the modern economy is going to be more difficult. It's going to come a bit slower. It's going to operate in different ways. But the first thing you want is, can people in the villages basically start feeding themselves? Are you able to get basic kind of education, schooling back there? Are you able to get some rudimentary health care back in the area? There are existing institutions. And I was just talking with a friend, Karen Jacobson from Fletcher, who's been working on a project of refugees in post-conflict situation. And she was just saying, whenever you're in these areas, the thing that is surprising is the degree to which people are getting on with their lives, that there are networks, there are communities here that are still functioning. So the question is, how do you help those communities to function? Now, one thing that has worked very effectively, the Indonesian case, it was very important. It also has been in Kenya. It's also worked pretty well in Ghana, is to use some limited funds to have a system for reconstructing the infrastructure that basically use people, simple tools. And what has worked, the Indonesian case, was there was an amount of money that was available to each district era for projects that used that 80% of the expense was on labor and then local materials, culverts, bridges, feeder roads. Those things are incredibly important, and it has two advantages. It gets income back to the poorest people. You have to keep the wages low in this. Otherwise, rich people will then hire themselves and then hire poor people back to do the work on their farms. If you have it so it's open, so that indeed it's an option for poor people to work, particularly in off seasons, to help rebuild the infrastructure that will increase their productivity, it's a way of getting some incomes in a fairly short period of time. And I think I can't overemphasize the importance of roads in basic roads in rural areas to be able to get seeds, tools, implements in, if they're successful feeding themselves, of having some surplus, get that out. You need to feed the cities. There are other people there. That's the first. It's a first set. Again, in Uganda, it's just very clear that improvement of rural roads has been a very important part of the story of getting that rural economy going, and then providing some reasonable incentives for people to help themselves. They need to have the tools, the seeds, the ability. They have to be able to get it in. If they're able to grow a surplus, they have to be able to get it out. And that starts raising real incomes at the bottom in very important ways. Another thing that has worked quite effectively in a number of areas are small-scale so-called microcredit institutions. In Liberia, like elsewhere, there's lots of association, rotating credit associations where friends or people get together, put some money in the pot, and then each person in turn has a chance to draw it out. That's been useful. Other forms of microcredit, small-scale banks. And what's important for rural people is not only to be able to have credit to buy things, but to have a way that if they're able to accumulate some savings, that they're able to hold them safely. And to be able to. So the whole issue of these community-based, you can get some NGO help from organizations like Working Assets, et cetera. There's a number of organizations. But again, for these to be successful, they have to really be based in the communities to revitalize those village economies and then to have a mechanism that people are able to save. Those, I think, are the very first priorities. Obviously, there will be some, if there's a successful plan, some international assistance can be used. A crucial part is how do you use it in ways that don't displace local initiative. And, for instance, for some help into these decentralized, labor-intensive rural works programs is a way that some assistance can be used. You can use some assistance as some capital, and you have to worry about the terms on it for these local credit institutions. And then, obviously, reconstruction is needed. The ports need to be repaired. The whole basic infrastructure for that urban economy also is important. At some point, yes, some external investment coming in to start rehabilitating first some existing facilities and then to start building will be important. But successful development is not going to be driven solely by external investment or aid. It's basically mobilizing the resources of people there. And that leads me back then to the most important resource that you have, which is the skilled diaspora, Liberians who have been forced abroad, who in this process have built skills, have resources in various ways. The question is, how can you tap those resources so they flow back to Liberia in ways that are effective in development? Again, Uganda drew back a substantial number of people and benefited. Eritrea, an obvious case, bringing that. Ghana has been quite successful in bringing people back. Sometimes it's a matter of people going back and staying. Sometimes have been people who by now have a base here but have been able to set up joint arrangements with other associates in the economy. They provide, obviously, skills and resources investment. They also give know-how. Another case, quite different, if you look at the use of a effective use of a diaspora, you look at Taiwan, the experience has been important, in India. More recently, the role then of skilled immigrants, of then being able to form channels where they have marketing, where they have technical know-how of working with institutions, frequently other parts of the extended family, the matter of the diaspora has been drawn on quite effectively. So I think these are a few things to think about. There are clearly opportunities if you can get a restoration of order and some kind of a political system that will let people get on with rebuilding their lives.
Thank you, John. Richard?
I am a social activist, so we're going to look at our discussion from the social point of view as it relates to the economy and the building of manpower for the reconstruction of Liberia. As most of you know, Liberia has gone through practically four republics. The first one was 1847 when we had our independence. That was our first republic. The second republic was when we had a coup in 1980. The third republic has been the transitional period, and now we're in the fourth republic. The question is, what can Liberians do in this new republic? And from the point of view that we're going to address, we have a series of questions that we will draw from. Ivan Leonard Markovic, an internationally known politician and writer, wrote, "New nations need more than bargaining power to gain the respect of the world. They need to demonstrate positive achievement. A responsible opposition can help win the struggle for unity, freedom, social betterment, and racial equality." Now, there are a series of questions that is faced, that we are faced with as Liberians in the process of development. One has to do with how can we bridge the gap of tribalism and sectionalism in Liberia. As you all know, the war partly has to do with tribalism and sectionalism. And the points that we have to demonstrate how we can do that is by conscientizing citizens of the general group of nationalism. We need to conscientize our citizens so that they know that Liberia is a whole. And if Liberia is hurt, we are all hurt, regardless whether you belong to a tribal group or you come from a county. We belong to a whole, and that whole is Liberia. The sense of awareness for that needs to be created through training and community involvement in what it takes to change the mentality of our people, democracy and human rights. We should focus on prohibiting the rise of dictatorship, because the issue here is that when people come to power in Liberia, the power is centralized at the presidency. And so what happened is people look up to the president for everything instead of the president looking up to the people to to make decisions and to run their own lives. Now, we should encourage social policy. Now, the social policy that we have to encourage is through national reconciliation. The war took place at the Ghana Peace Accord. One of the things that we talked about was to set up a peace and reconciliation committee or bureau that will handle what happened during the war. I recommend here that we look at the South African policy and the way the South Africans were able to set up a committee to look at apartheid in South Africa, and they investigated and brought those that were involved in apartheid, involved in heinous act against humanity, to justice. We need to do that in Liberia. We also need to encourage the rule of law. We have to help translate the vision of democracy into a practical reality. Now, what I mean by that is that Liberians, we, according to our statistic, we have 85% illiteracy rate. Now, in order for us to have people participate in the democracy of Liberia, they have to be educated on their rights. People have to know that they hold the trump card for electing a president. They hold the trump card for electing a senator. And we have to know that if they go to the ballot box, regardless of tribalism, they should vote for someone that has the country at heart. And so by doing that, you will realize that people will know that Liberia belongs to everybody. We have to also have civic education and participation. And what do I mean by that? We have to conduct and develop the capacity of refugees. You realize that since the last 15 years, refugees have been in camps, some without the resources to go to school, children without the resources to go to school. And so 15 years, if a child was 5, 15 years, he is 20 and has not had any real formal education. In the new republic that we're talking about building, we have to be able to encourage training so that these kids, including me, who have come here in pursuit of better life, will be able to have the same opportunity to do so. Now, the next question that we have to consider is, how can we most effectively utilize our natural resources for economic sustainability? Now, most countries use the resources from their economy and from their resources to build infrastructure, to build manpower, to conduct training, so that the country benefits from it. Let's take, for example, our export is rubber and timber. The resources from those two export in Liberia, we all know those that have been in Liberia, that it has most of the time end up in the coffers of the presidency. Does not go to the people. These money come in, and sometimes even the companies that operate these corporations are run by the president is a shareholder into it. We need to discourage that. We need to use the resources from there in order to help build our country. The benefit that we can get from there is that we will import modern technology into Liberia. For example, if we were to say we want to encourage the establishment of factories for the processing of raw materials that we take from the rubber in Liberia, we have the single largest rubber plantation in the world next to Malaysia. And every gallon of rubber that is taken from Liberia is exported. We do nothing with it. All that we get paid from, all that our people get paid from, is to go in the bush, wake up 5 o'clock in the morning, tap the rubber, and bring that latex to the factory, and they take it from there and bring it to wherever they have to bring it. And people who they bring it to, they get the workforce and they get able to use whatever they have in those places that the rubber is processed to create jobs. We are saying that in the new republic, we should start the process in Liberia. That way, our people will be able to have jobs and we will be able to live on it. How can we effectively decentralize the national government? It's one issue that we have to consider, even though we're talking about election. As I said in the beginning, power is concentrated at the presidency. We need to look at the different subdivisions of the country and elect our superintendent, elect our judges, elect our county officials, so that they are accountable to the people, not to the presidency. The establishment of a viable and effective run tax system, both on the national and local level. Now, what happened in Liberia is that in 1980, when the Dole government came into being, they abolished the tax system. They said, we will live on whatever we have, there's no taxes. And in the end, they have to create what is called a saving bond, which no one even was able to cash in. They created a saving bond to be able to get out of the mess. So what we need to do is to create a tax system that will bring that money into the government that people will be able to utilize. The next question that is on the mind of people that we have to consider for discussion is how can we encourage the participation of equipped Liberians in the diaspora? Our previous speaker here spoke to that. Now, we have, according to the immigration census report, we have over 250 Liberians here in the United States. And over 250,000, Liberians in the United States. Of that number, we have doctors, we have engineers, we have nurses, we have all levels of trade here in the United States. How we encourage them to go back for the development that we're talking about is a crucial issue that we have to look at. And because of time, I submit.
Thank you. Lady?
Before I present what I have, I first want to make some corrections. This is nice, but you know, it's not me. I'm assistant professor of mathematics education in the School of Education. I'm not based in the mathematics department, just for the record. Dr. Nnamdi Azikiwe, who was the first prime minister of Nigeria, in his doctoral thesis, mentioned that if the trend of events in Liberia continues, there will be a disaster in Liberia. And this was in the 50s. And it happened in the late 80s up to throughout the 90s. And that was, he based his prediction on the two groups of people that existed in Liberia and how the indigenous people were denied of education. President Tubman's the longest paved highway was from Monrovia to the president's farm. So these are just to give you a little bit information about how all this problem, you know, started. It wasn't an overnight issue. And so to rebuild Liberia, we have to go back and revisit our history. I know some of us don't like to talk about the history, about the settlers and indigenous people, but that's part of our history. We have to respect it. We have to keep it, but we have to move on. We use that as a means to develop our country. One of the first things that come to mind when we talk about reconstructing Liberia is, first of all, there has to be resettlement of refugees. And in fact, that's the reason why I don't think it is possible to have elections in 2005 when so many people are out of the country. So resettlement is one of the first things. People have to be resettled and get their normal lives together, go back to the farms, go back to the villages, kids going to school. And once we have the resumption of normal life, we start talking about elections. Number two is how do we rehabilitate the former fighters, particularly the young ones? If you look at some of the police report from different states, particularly in Rhode Island and in Minnesota, a considerable number of Liberian youth are being incarcerated. And these are kids who were holding guns in Liberia, came to this country, and they never went through that rehabilitation process. As a result, they still be haunted by what they went through, and they continue to go into that path. And so there's a serious need for rehabilitation of ex-combatants. Giving them $300 for the gun is just the tip of the iceberg. The social and emotional problem that exists has to be taken care of. And that can be done through building schools and also having special programs for these people. The other issue that I have on my list, which has been alluded to, is the developing rural economy. And a lot of the things that happen in Liberia now is not because of the war. These things have been there before the war. Liberia was not, compared to Ghana, Nigeria, and so on, Liberia was, if not the first independent country in Africa, but was still behind in terms of education, in terms of infrastructure, in so many things. And so, for example, developing rural economy is not even the problem of the war. This happened from the very day the country was established. A typical example is you live in Kipamas, you're a high school teacher, you have to travel to Monrovia to get your salary. What that means is that you travel by road for 2 days. No school going on. When a paymaster goes to Kipamas to pay people, it takes about 2-3 days for a teacher to get a pay. There's no banking system. The Lebanese mayor keeps your money. These are the basic needs, basic necessities. If we look at the education system, you graduate from high school in Voinjima, you have to go to Monrovia to go to the University of Liberia. There has to be decentralization of post-secondary education so that you don't have to travel across the country to go to school. Also, what is needed is basic education for all, particularly in the rural areas. Some of us grew up in a system where you have to walk at least 4 miles one way to go to school. You come back home, you finish elementary school in your village, you have to move to the nearest town to go to high school. And sometimes you don't know anybody there. You have to stay with someone to go to school. After that, you move to the next city or you move to Monrovia to go to college. And if you are not careful, you will end up not finishing high school, particularly for women. They become very vulnerable easily because they leave the villages, go to the town. These are problems that existed long before the war. And I think that in order for us to build Liberia, this is a great opportunity for us to rebuild the country because we have to go back and revisit some of the mistakes that we made in the past and try to correct them. Education has become a social justice issue. It is a priority on our agenda. Kids needs to be empowered. And the only way we can empower our kids is through education. They are the future of the country. We need to build more schools in the rural areas. We need to decentralize our post-secondary education. University of Liberia can have different campuses or different colleges in different parts of the country. You don't have to travel across the country to go to the one university. If you look in the Liberian Constitution, it says that education is compulsory. Yes, that's fine. But who is going to pay for it? What happens is that most parents cannot afford to send their kids to school. And so you enter in a classroom, you find a child who is about 15 years old and is in the second grade, a child who is 10 years old in the third grade. What we need is a system that will guarantee basic education for all kids, at least at the primary school level for now, as we think about reconstructing Liberia. How can we do that? Liberia has natural resources that we can use to help reconstruct our country. Basic health education. The other important issue is the civic education. In order for us to have a democratic government, in order for people to vote because they are informed, we need basic civic education for all people. If it means you have an adult literacy program, why am I voting for this person? Is it because we come from the same village? Or is it because we come from the same region? Or is it because, he has the money and he can buy me a bag of rice? we have to develop strategies in reaching the people in the rural area so that they will be educated in order to vote for the person who they feel can do the work. It's not because of some sort of pressure on them or because somebody's holding a gun. I think I've run out of time. Thank you.
Madam Barrett.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, the panel discussion tonight on the theme, Rebuilding Liberia, an Agenda for Self-Sustainable Socio-Economic Development, closed the series of discussions we have had on how to give a new start on a firm foundation for a better, prosperous, and peaceful future. The speakers this evening have eloquently done justice to the subject. I highly commend them for their excellent presentations. However, as we look forward to rebuilding Liberia, I must emphasize that our plans, strategies, and methodologies for doing so must evolve from the context of total national awareness and participation. The people of Liberia must be adequately educated and then mobilized to actively participate in charting a new course for the nation. It is against this background that I have come to sincerely believe that Liberians must hold a national conference on the future of Liberia in Liberia before any elections or any elections are conducted. Let Liberians in the end be able to say we did it ourselves and not they did it. Additionally, attempts at rebuilding Liberia will mean very little if a census of the national population is not taken before elections. In addition to revealing the number of eligible voters in the country, the census will enable us to plan and strategize about implementation of nationwide development programs and subjects or projects as we look forward to building a new state for ourselves. Finally, I may once again extend my thanks and appreciation to the Boston University African Studies Center and APAC for giving me the honor of being a participant in all three panel discussions that they have fittingly organized on the rebuilding of Liberia. The presentations, discussions, and interactions have truly been heartwarming. I would therefore also like to thank all the moderators, presenters, and members of the audience for their part in making the panel series a memorable one, especially for me. And before I end, I want to say thanks to the following persons who brought out the suggestion for a national conference in Liberia. And they are Dr. Patrick Sayan. Thank you very much. And Councillor Tiwon Gonglo and Mr. George Waters Slewan. Is he here? And Ronelle Vanny. We want to say thank you because there is a need for us to really have a national conference in Liberia. And also we're suggesting, we were in D.C. yesterday meeting with other organizations there like the Africa. Women in
Waging Peace.
Women Waging Peace were with them, and some ambassadors, both international and national, you know, African ambassadors, and we discussed this. We presented our plight to them, and I hope all Liberians here will see that there is a need for us first before election, because we feel election will be too soon at this point, and we will not succeed. The problem will be like what I faced when I became head of state, and we don't want it to be repeated. So we all should encourage these presenters, these proposers, so that we have a national conference, and then we have census taking. Because you do go voting somewhere, and you don't have any idea of the number of in fact, the population as a whole. So we are asking all Liberians within the diaspora to join us who are at home for us to have this conference. And we should push to the United Nations, and we'll soon be going there. We hope we'll be heard there too. Thank you very much.
Let me take the opportunity to thank the panel for an exciting discussion. We Liberians are, of course, are the ones who are going to reconstruct our country. We're going to find the path out of where we got from the vehicle that drove us there and over the cliff. And we're going to have to recognize also that there's not a single Liberian during this conflict who has not, one way or the other, been affected. The pain that all of us have had to live with is the basis for us to decide to become a better people in a better society so that no one feels left out, no one feels isolated, no one feels marginalized, and we can all feel that we are all Liberians working for the betterment of our country. Thanks.
You've been listening to the final of three panel discussions being presented by Boston University's African Studies Center and the African Presidential Archives and Research Center. Tonight's discussion was entitled Rebuilding Liberia. Beginning this Friday, Boston University plays host to the America East Conference Men's Basketball Championship at Walter Brown Arena. The winner secures a bid to the NCAA Division I basketball tournament. Last year, the Terrier men lost the championship game by one heartbreaking point to the University of Vermont. World of Ideas recently sat down with BU coach Dennis Wolf to talk about this year's outstanding season and the Terriers' March Madness bid. Coach, the team has put up some pretty impressive numbers this season, more than 20 wins and just a handful of losses overall. What's the secret to the success of the team?
Well, I don't think it's any one thing. If I could tell you what the secret was and bottle it, then I'd be trying to use it every year. I think we have very good chemistry, and we have a nice group of kids that have bought into the philosophy that we've tried to instill in them. So, we're just very fortunate, and we're trying to keep them grounded enough so we can sustain it.
And going back to the start of the season, that first practice, or let's go to the first game of the season, did you anticipate then that you would be in the position that you're in now?
No, I don't think that we anticipated this type of success. I think that we knew we had some positions we need to fill based on some guys graduating from last year. I think that we thought that if some guys played as they have played, we had the potential to be as good as we were last year, and we had a good team last year. But I don't know if we thought, we lost our first three games of the year. So, I remember after that third loss, albeit we played St. Joe's, who's the second-ranked team in the country, and we played BC, who's going to be an NCAA tournament team, and we lost a close game at Holy Cross to open the season. I remember sitting there saying to myself, hey, when are we going to get our next one? It's been a thing that has gradually built up, and we had a tough loss in the middle of January at home to Vermont in a game that we could have won and didn't. And, then there were a lot of questions about how the kids would respond from that point. The things have gone, about as well as any coach could ask, and we just are enjoying it and hope we can continue.
You mentioned that some of the players had graduated from last year to this year. Can you tell us a little bit more about the makeup of the team? Are there many freshmen on this squad?
Well, we have two freshmen who have kind of worked their way in a little bit, but not, we have a veteran team, and we have five seniors, four of whom play a lot. Kevin Fitzgerald, Matt Turner, Jason Grokowski, and Ryan Butt have all been integral parts of the team playing for the last 4 years. And Daniel Dackrat is another senior who's also contributed in a lot of different ways, although he doesn't play quite as much. We have two juniors who are two of our better players, Chaz Carr, who's second-team All-New England player, and Rashad Bell. And we've gotten terrific minutes out of our two sophomores, Kevin Gardner, a 6'9 guy from California, and Sean Wynn, a 6'3 guy from New York. So those two didn't play much last year as freshmen, and Sean in particular has had an all-league type of year, and Kevin has contributed terrifically inside. So that's the makeup of the team, and it's been a good group.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned keeping the players grounded, and I would imagine that for any of the players, this is an overwhelming experience. But for the younger players, is this something that as a freshman or a younger student, do you approach them any differently?
Well, I think you need to make sure that you're constantly reminding them about what's important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at a place like BU where there's so much diversity and there's so many different things going on, and, you know, our hockey team has had unbelievable national success, and, you know, and I've been the coach here for 10 years and we've had successful teams. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's ever been quite the interest in the team that there seems to be in this team. So I think one of the dangers is, you know, guys walking around campus and everybody patting them on the back and telling them how great they are, and they forget about, you know, what's made them good and what's made us play well enough to win. So, you know, some days when they come over here at 3 o'clock for practice, I have to kind of hammer down on them and make sure that they're clear about what's important.
And I'd like to talk just for a moment, if I could, if you wouldn't mind, about college sports in general, because the public hears sensational stories at other schools. The most recent thing I guess we've heard is the Colorado football team and accusations of using sex and booze to recruit players. Mm-hmm. What's your reaction when you hear something like this? Does this send a chill through all of intercollegiate athletics?
Well, you know, I think part of my reaction is it's not nearly as widespread mm-hmm. as it's reported, because, you know, you know from your business that, you know, the sensational is what sells. So, you know, things get blown up and then everybody gets dragged and painted with the same brush. Sure. You know, I think a lot of it has to do with the culture at the school, and I think, you know, we're at a place that, you know, has zero tolerance for anything other than the kids behaving like normal students, you know, and, you know, I think they hire coaches that believe in that, and we try to proceed that way. Mm-hmm. You're in somewhat of a dangerous time in that the coach seems to be the person that's responsible for everything, you know, so, yeah. You know, guy leaves and he's out of your watch, you know, in the middle of the night. You know, you might have the greatest rules in the world. You may, and a guy, 18 or 19-year-old kid, makes a bad decision. It impacts your career. So, you know, there's checks and balances that you have to have in place. You have to try to stay on top of them consistently and make sure that they understand that there's a level of behavior and there's, you know, a zero tolerance for anything other than trying to be a good citizen and a good player.
Mm-hmm. And do the students, how do they react to something like that? Do they come to you and say, Coach, I heard, you know, and express an opinion about what they hear, the things that are going on at other schools?
Well, you know, I think they're aware that, you know, things have happened, you know, at other places. And you know, we try to do a good job here of educating the kids. You know, we had a fabulous speaker in through our academic area recently, that a guy that was a college athlete that had been involved in DUI somewhere. Mm. And you really work hard to try to educate the kids. And you know, but again, I've done this for 25 years. You know, sometimes with these kids this age, telling them, unfortunately, things that have happened to other people, they always come back with, well, this will never happen to me. One of the things I'm constantly reminding them is they're held to a higher standard. You know, and that's a fact. It's unfortunate. But, you know, you and I, if we were just a regular student blending in here and made a mistake or did something wrong, it nearly wouldn't attract the attention that it does if you're an athlete. So, you know, again, the guys like the attention when things are going well, so they have to understand that there's the potential for negative attention if they're doing the wrong things.
Coach, you've recently logged your 200th win as a coach. What does that mean to you? What's that like?
Well, it means I'm getting older. That's the first thing. It means that I've been very fortunate, particularly here where the majority of the wins have come, that I've coached very good players during the 10 years I've been the coach here. You know, it's something I think that I dwell on when the season's over. You know, when you're in the middle of what we have going on right now, you don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. But it's something I am proud of, mainly because of the relationships I've had with the guys that have helped us mm-hmm. do it.
And turning now to, I guess, the task that is immediately at hand, coming up, the America East Conference Championship. What kind of challenges do you see heading into that tournament?
You know, we've been very lucky in the time that I've been here. We've been in the championship game 5 times. We've gone twice to the NCAA tournament, and you know, it's a fabulous thing to have as a goal, but it's a very difficult thing to achieve. You know, mm-hmm. because you're playing 2 consecutive games, and then you have a week before the championship game. And
right.
you know, and last year we made it to the championship game, and Vermont played well, and a guy made a shot at the buzzer, and unfortunately they won. So mm-hmm. I think our guys are motivated to get back. This has been a very focused group, so I haven't really had to, they would like to get back. If you're a college basketball player, the idea that you're involved in March Madness is a fabulous thing. So,
right.
you know, I'm hopeful that that will push us forward.
Is there one team in particular that you're eyeing as far as than another?
No, because I think that, while we've been fortunate to win games, we've had a number of tough games with just sure. about everybody. So, you know, one of the ways we've been successful is just to worry about whoever we're playing next.
Any final thoughts heading into the championship?
No, I'm more than anything grateful that, we have played the way that we have, and that there seems to be the attention, here at BU and within Boston for the way these kids have played, because they have played a very unselfish, energetic style of basketball that, if we can get people to come out and watch them play, I think they're going to go away thinking that, I saw a good game and I saw a good team.
Boston University men's basketball coach Dennis Wolf. The BU Terriers host the America East Conference Basketball Championship beginning this Friday at Walter Brown Arena. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by John Perotti and Tim Skog with help from Matt Odeff. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.